call the meeting to order. Welcome, everyone. We are here for the Regent Council Advisory Committee meeting. If you are here for any other reason, you might want to find the room where you want to be. We have a full agenda today. I'd like to first introduce myself. I'm Harriet Porter, and I am one of two vice chairs of the committee. Ardell Breed, our chair, was not able to be with us today. So I will be filling in his very big shoes. To my right is Jerry Rogers, who is also a vice chair. But we'd like to start with introductions. Most of us know each other, but not everyone. So we're just going to quickly go around the room and do introductions. And then we have a tradition also of inviting our guests to introduce themselves as well. So, George, if I could start with you, and we'll just go around this way.
My name is George Sundstrom. I live in Duluth, and I'm a representative from the district. The only representative.
I'm Kathy Mattson. I live in Burnsville, and I'm a representative of District 2.
I'm Dan Walter. I'm from Eagan. I'm also a representative of District 2.
I'm Daryl Thompson from Plymouth, Minnesota.
And Sally keeps us in order. I am also a representative from the 6th Congressional District.
I'm Jerry Rogers. I'm from the 7th District. And I just might comment, people look at me funny today. I haven't had a stroke. I got this Bell's palsy thing from a couple days ago. So sometimes I tell them the other night that I wasn't drinking when they were talking on the phone. It was just sometimes doesn't work right. So just it's not a big deal, but...
I'm Pat Duncanson. I'm from Blue Earth County, Mapleton, Minnesota, in the 1st District.
Jim Erickson, 5th District, Minneapolis.
Bert McAsey from Mendota Heights.
Paul Taylor, Minnetonka, Minnesota, 3rd Congressional District.
Lois Josephson, Fergus Falls, Minnesota, 7th Congressional District.
And I actually gave you the wrong district. I am now in District 4. So, Linda, you're going to speak with us later, as well as some of our other guests, but if you would like to introduce yourself, we'll just go around the audience real quick.
Well, I'm Linda Cohen, the current regent, and I'll expand on that just so you have some background.
Okay.
Jason Langworthy, also staff to the Board of Regents.
I'm Mark Malander, the committee administrator for the House Higher Education and Finance Committee.
Okay.
I'm his counterpart in the Senate. I work for David Kornacki. I work for Senator Potthoff, the chair of IRN.
Okay.
I'm Greg Gibbinger with the Legislative Coordinating Commission and the Salaries Office.
Awesome. Thank you very much. As I said, we have a full agenda. And the first thing on the agenda is to approve the meetings from our June 10th meeting. So if I could ask you to take those out of your packet and review those.
Madam Chair, we did miss one introduction.
Oops.
She's hiding.
Oh, behind. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Don't worry about it. I'm Diane Henry Weinstein. I'm also staff with the office.
You're hiding, Diane.
Yeah, I am.
So we'll give you a couple of minutes to look over these, and then we will look for a motion to approve.
So moved.
Second.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Okay, approved. So with that, we will invite Linda Cohen to join us. And Brian, we're going to have you come up at the same time.
Well, first of all, good morning, everybody, and thanks very much for having me come and talk a little bit about some of the attributes. And more importantly, really, thank you all for the really hard work you do. It's such an important job, and so for the time and energy that you put in, thanks so much. Very, very much appreciated. I think most of you know me, but I'll just take a minute to briefly introduce who I am. I'm Linda Cohen, and I've been a member of the Board of Regents since 2007. There were a few of you who were here when I had to be up here a little more nervous than I am now, talking about why I was interested in being a regent. I also have been chair of the board. I was chair of the Board of Regents from 2011 to 2013. And just last year, in March of 2013, I was elected to a second term as a regent. And so I both understand the process, I remember it very vividly, and also have had 7 years' experience on the Board of Regents. Based on that experience, as I thought about what stands out for me about what's really important about being a regent, and the thing that really hit me was good judgment. Now, I realize when I say good judgment, that's something that's very hard to measure and to get a handle on when you're interviewing people. But it's so important. I think there are a couple things about that, that one can see a large picture and you don't focus too much just on the small details, but there's an objectivity about looking at a big picture. On the other hand, it's also important to think about and to be aware of and carefully know the details of the situation so that you can make an objective judgment. But that's what's one of the things that stands out for me is the kind of judgment that somebody brings. And so good luck to all of you in assessing that in the candidates that you have. Serving on the Board of Regents is kind of like walking a tightrope. It's a balancing act. It's a balancing act that's carried out under pretty close scrutiny. And it's weighing the interests of multiple stakeholders and avoiding micromanagement at the same time. One of the things that strikes me also as being so important is an understanding of governance. That you understand that governance is not managing or operating the university. It's the oversight, the fiduciary responsibility, the making sure that the mission is being fulfilled. As I said, the role of a regent requires an open mind, a critical eye, being a team player, I believe, and Harriet will know that that's one of my favorite themes, but I do believe that having a collaborative, cohesive board helps the board function better. So being a team player is really important. And having the time. There's a lot to do as a regent to learn about higher education, not only the University of Minnesota system, which is extremely complex, and that's one of the fun parts of being a regent is I learn something new every day, but time to learn about higher education nationally, time to engage in firsthand experiences, which our board staff is wonderful about providing, visiting some of the outlying campuses, meeting with students and faculty, so we really gain a true understanding of the organization. And finally, so that you have time to get to know and understand the president and his leadership team. The board depends on the president being really strong, and I believe one of the really important functions of the board is to help the president be successful. And yet, one doesn't want to do that kind of with a blind eye. You want to also be assessing how is the president doing, how are we doing, toward really reaching our vision and fulfilling our mission. I do think the Board of Regents has done a good job of striking the balance of weighing the time elements, a lot of things, and by developing a culture of engagement, transparency, and effective governance. And then I wanted to mention one other thing that I think is really important in having that kind of culture. How does one avoid having regents who have major conflicts of interest? I know that when I became a regent, I had been on the, or I was still serving on the Humphrey School Advisory Council, was something that was very interesting to me, and I liked doing it a lot. And yet I felt that it was very important that I not be seen or perceived as somebody who was sort of a special interest in one element of the university. And so I think any sort of, it's hard to recognize all the kinds of conflicts of interest that there might be, but how important it is. And so I resigned from the Humphrey School Advisory Board. And so, as I said, the role of a regent requires objectivity and to make sure that as much as possible that there aren't glaring conflicts of interest. And in addition to university affiliations, career and other affiliations can be both positive and negative in terms of conflicts of interest. If there are some and one recuses oneself, then some of the expertise that one hopes that one brings to the Board of Regents is lost. And so that's going to be a hard job for you all to assess also. So being a regent is both challenging, and it's been a pure pleasure and rewarding, and a privilege for me to be serve as a regent. I have a great affection for the University of Minnesota, starting with my parents. I also received my PhD from the University of Minnesota, and so it has been a great joy for me to serve as a regent. And again, thank you for inviting me, and I'm happy to answer questions after Brian talks. And so I want to turn it over to Brian, who is our executive director of the board and the corporate secretary. And Brian does a terrific job of really promoting excellent governance while keeping 12 pretty independent players in line. So, Brian.
Well, thank you, and Madam Chair. As Regent Cohen alluded to, higher education governance is very challenging. It's one of those areas where it's incredibly difficult because of the number of constituencies and groups that feel so vested in that university. And frankly, some boards, if you've followed higher education press at all in recent in the past year or two, you've seen that some boards have faltered in this area and have done so in ways that have made headlines all across the country. And so with the kind of high-pressure situation and the challenging issues that are facing higher education, it's a really critical and kind of pivotal time for higher education boards. Ultimately, as Regent Cohen mentioned, higher education governing boards are responsible for co-creating a vision with the president that will advance and fulfill the mission of the institution. That's ultimately what they need to do. They need to work in partnership with that leader that they've selected and evaluate and drive the institution forward. Over the next year at the University of Minnesota, we will begin to implement a new strategic plan for the Twin Cities campus. There'll be continued efforts to strengthen the university's health sciences programs. There'll be a continued emphasis on reducing administrative expenditures and reinvesting those resources into the academic mission of the university. And in addition to that, we'll do the normal things we do, which is to educate the future teachers and doctors and farmers and leaders of Minnesota, and also serve as a real economic engine for the state. So there's a lot going on at the university. And so during this pivotal time, what do we need from a board? We need a board that is engaged. We need a board that's effective. And we need a board that's really focused on those things that matter most to a governing board. And I think about those in terms of, I kind of think of four big things. You need a board that's focused on the vision for the future. You need a board that is a strong partner with the president but has a real clear grasp of the roles and responsibilities of both the president and the board. You need a board that has a keen understanding of the importance of benchmarks and measures to evaluate progress so that you know whether you're making progress toward that vision. And ultimately, the last thing I'll mention is you also need a board that has a good sense of risks. Risks of both action and inaction, because sometimes there's more risk to not doing something than there is to doing. So that's the kind of board that we need, and I think that Regent Cohen is right that this board has really cultivated a culture of effectiveness. This board works well together and is a very strong board. Looking to the future, the important thing is going to be sustaining that culture and continuing to have a board that is engaged, that asks probing questions, that has the information and tools it needs to govern effectively. So thinking about what you should be looking for in candidates, new board members really, the board will benefit from having new board members that really embrace the complex role of a governing board. They understand it and embrace it. And that can support the president while also bringing a strategic and sometimes critical eye to issues. And it's that dual role that's very difficult to maintain, but it's the secret sauce, you know, to the success of a board. And people that can analyze and understand the impact of decisions that are being made, both in the short term and the long term. And then I think the final thing that I'd emphasize is that it's vitally important for regents to be collaborative and to be constructive in how they approach the work of the board. They need to bring their diverse experiences and expertise and perspectives, but they also need to be open to listening and curious about the perspectives of others and the way that past decisions have been made and why they were made. And so that's a critically important thing. I think that between the comments that Regent Cohen has made and some of the points that she's emphasized and some of these things here that I've outlined, if we can get regents that have those qualities, we will set the board up for success both in the short and long term, and set the university up for success in the long term. So with that, I'll conclude my comments, and obviously we'd both be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Questions?
Through the chair, Regent Cohen, this isn't a question, but the regent from the district, Dave McMillan, and I didn't ask him about it, but he told me that he has the greatest respect for you as the chairperson of the board. He said she does a great job as the chairperson.
Well, thank you very much. It's a very nice comment. It was a great honor and privilege to be chair. I became chair when President Kaler came to the university, and so it was a 2-year term, and so working closely with President Kaler as he began was a great privilege and was really interesting. And I guess one of the things that I worked very hard was to establish collaboration among the board members. And I think our current chair, Rick Beeson, has continued doing that.
Madam Chair?
Go ahead, Pat.
A question on time. One of the things that we ask about, and I'm hoping we asked you, but we try to ask candidates about their ability to commit to time. We have been told that there is an estimate of approximately 40 hours per month as a volunteer. I would like you to respond to that, if you would. And then in thinking about that time and in thinking about how we create a board that represents all of Minnesota, it's easier to recognize one's accomplishments when they've had an entire career to build up those accomplishments. It's much more difficult to assess their abilities when they're maybe only partway in. How do we, as a council, how can you help us? Can you give us any hints about, first of all, the time commitment that a mid-career person might have to make, and also that balance that you spoke about? And certainly from a board perspective, I would think there's certain balance that could be gained.
Well, a couple good questions. And maybe Brian can have some comments too on the time. I think being a regent and not in a chair or vice chair position, that 40 hours per month is a generous estimate. I don't think it's more than that. Part of it is also that for me, and what I've recognized is that there's a little flexibility in when I want to spend some of that time, because in preparation for the board meetings and the committee meetings themselves, which are eight times a year, we get the materials or they're available about a week before, so I can space it out. And if I want to do a couple of hours every night for six nights, I can do that. And so there is a certain flexibility in how and when you spend the time. In some cases, there isn't. For the actual meetings themselves, it's very important that you're there, and so there is no flexibility in that. Also, there are a lot of ceremonial, I'd put it, things where it's important that regents attend, but not all regents. So I think that as long as there's a good regent representation at some of these things, not everybody has to do everything. I haven't found, certainly when I was chair, it became a full-time job, but other than, but as being a regent in general, I think one can regulate that time, and part of it you can do when it fits your schedule, and part of it you can't. Your second question is a really good question, I think, on in terms of, because how does one assess candidates when they haven't had a whole sort of career of accomplishment or experiences or whatever? And again, and maybe that's why I focused on something that's hard to assess, but to me there are many things that are attitudinal, and this good judgment and objectivity that aren't based merely on experience. And how does one ask the questions of candidates so that you all can get a reading on what the attitudes and what the objectivity and so on and judgment is? I'll leave up to you. But I do think your point of it's important to have regents at different stages in their careers, and so it's important not only to look at, well, what kind of experiences have you had? It's helpful to look at some of those other qualities too. Maybe Bryant has some wisdom on all this.
Well, I think I would agree that there's flexibility in when those hours are spent in terms of the time question. Certainly the eight board meetings, the expectation and culture of our board is that you will attend all meetings of the board. So absences are rare, and you know, kind of the expectation is that you'll be there for all the board meetings. Outside of that, though, there are a number of things that regents do, but it is more optional or as your schedule permits. There's ceremonial functions. There's educational opportunities to learn more about the university so that you can apply that to your governance responsibilities. We do small group visits to various campuses. Those would be a lot of times over the course of a couple days. So I think if you added up all the time that a person spends on board work and then divided by 12, you probably get the number you're talking about. But it's uneven. It's not consistently 40. And with regard to the other question, I completely agree with Regent Cohen in that trying to get the right fit for the position is maybe as or more important than looking at what's on their resume specifically in terms of experience. And one way to potentially do that is to really think hard about how you want to use your reference checks and how you want to make reference calls about these people to ascertain more about how they work with others and how they and what kinds of, you know, what their judgment is like as a person. I think reference checks can be a valuable tool in something like that.
Thank you. Paul?
Brian Steves, you mentioned health sciences as a very important focus. Regent Cohen, you're right in the middle of health sciences with a husband and a brother-in-law. and currently serving as the chair of a newly created committee that's focusing on that important area. The state of Minnesota is losing a remarkable resource in health sciences with the completion of the second term for Dr. Patricia Simmons. What advice would you give us in terms of looking at finding a replacement for that kind of a resource as we start our work?
I'm going to be very straightforward with the committee. And Paul, one of the things, and that's why I mentioned about the conflict of interest, one of the things that has been difficult for the board has been that Regent Simmons clearly has tremendous knowledge and expertise. But because of her position at Mayo, the kind of position she has had to recuse herself from almost everything that has to do with our academic medicine and health sciences. And so because of the conflict of interest. And so it hasn't been as helpful to the board as it might have been. So that's where I think you can, one of the things you can do is certainly it would be helpful to have somebody who's knowledgeable about the fields of medicine and health and so on today, but to assess whether or not they're in a position that almost automatically creates a conflict of interest.
Thank you.
Or not.
Jim?
Lois, were you there? Please.
I was going to, but go ahead.
Please.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Lois.
Regent Cohen, following up quickly on that statement, Mr. Frobenius would fall within the parameter of being able to draw on his expertise, contrary to the example that you gave with Dr. Simmons? Is that
yes,
a fair statement?
Very much so, and he's been an invaluable member of the board, and because of his background as a hospital administrator and system administrator. So, yes.
Jim, did you have something?
A segue from Paul's question, I think. We've done a pretty good job, I think, of winnowing both the recruiting and winnowing out the applicants and sending you across the street, I guess, and then the board, ultimately the best. But we probably haven't been as careful or as thoughtful about what your need was. I mean, good people, yes, but so I'm thinking of the baseball or football or major league sports analogy. Every team needs strengths. You know, they need a switch hitting catcher or speed or in baseball or a big line. Can you give us some advice about as we recruit and winnow? What is or perhaps the major challenge or challenges facing university that you this board needs some expertise in? Paul referenced health sciences, and I stay in touch with some of the regents, and when I ask them what's the large issue facing the university, it's the medical school. So obviously that would be something that we would put on the list of things to try and find somebody that does that. Is there others? That's one that has been mentioned. Do you have other, you or Mr. Steves, have other issues or problems or major issues that you think you need? You don't have that switch hitting catcher, or you don't have that expertise that we could bring to the table or look for?
Well, Brian, maybe you want to take the first
whack
at it now.
Well, I guess what I would say is this. Certainly the health sciences is an important area, and we've talked clearly about that. But beyond that, I guess I would, you know, it's funny. One of the things in higher education, there's this debate that goes on about the value of a liberal arts education. And you know, the kind of this debate, like in some states, they're talking more about, you know, we need to drive people toward career-focused education where they're going to, you know, go in, get the skills they need, and go out and have that job. And other people say, no, you need this broad base of knowledge. And I guess I would fall on the side of the very best regents are those that are well-rounded, that are not necessarily those that bring great depth of experience in a particular area, but bring a cross section of experiences that can be brought to bear on all sorts of problems. Because the thing is regents will not there will never be a case where a regent can solely focus on health sciences, or can solely focus on athletics oversight, or can solely focus on certain academic endeavors. The university is everything. It's all those things, and the board has to engage with all of those issues and has to be well versed on all those things. And so the very best regents are those who will be able to engage across a wide range of issues. That's how I would answer that.
And as I look at it, I would compliment the RCAC and so on, in that I think that there is a span of expertise. I certainly agree with Brian. We all have to look at all sorts of different things, but there are people who have really a little more expertise in the financial area. There are people who have a little more expertise in the sort of educational aspects. There are people who have expertise in a lot of different areas. So it ends up, I would say it probably would be hard to look for somebody to fill a particular slot, and that you need that kind of overall objectivity. Although, as you mentioned, I think we are going to lose some health science.
So you don't think we need to look for a former football coach, for example?
Probably not. Although, who knows, maybe.
Regent Cohen, I guess, I'm sure everybody's goal here is to provide the best candidates to do the best job we can for the university in the state of Minnesota. Despite all this, there's a certain amount of a political process that has to be gotten through to get this done. Any insights, advice you might have as to how we might better fit through that process?
Well, I'm really glad you brought it up, because any way you can think of to depoliticize the process, I think the better off one is. I noticed a great difference when I ran 7 years ago, where there was much less political process, perhaps, than last year. But that's the sort of the state of our state and our world, is that things are much more lots of opposing points of view that don't tend to get together so much. So I think anything you can do to depoliticize that the candidates, the board really works hard and I think does a really good job of not being political. I mean, they are looking at issues as unbiased as possible and not from a particular political perspective. So I think any way that you can do that, and perhaps the idea, I know that there's some ideas of having the chairs of the higher education committees sitting on this committee. If you do, it would seem to me you'd want to get people from both parties legislators sitting on this committee, so that there'd be ownership from everybody about the candidates, that it wouldn't be one party's candidates. It's a very good question, and something I think that the more whatever you can do. One of the things that is really not under this committee, but the first time I ran, the higher education committees. Maybe you can take this back. Instead of having the full higher education committee, which means that the party and that's in the majority dominates, there were 10 people from the House and 10 from the Senate, 5 Democrats, 5 Republicans from each, and those were the people that moved the candidates forward. So there had to be some agreement. You couldn't just be moved forward by one party or another. So I think anything to depoliticize the process would be helpful.
I would just add, and I'll draw, one of the things that we've seen that has placed a great deal of stress on boards in other states is when you have a board member join that has an agenda, that they're coming to the board because they want to reform something. And it can be very politically popular to go through a process with that kind of campaign, so to speak, that you're going to be reforming certain parts of the university. But that's very detrimental when you get to the board because, and we've seen this in other states, you read about the University of Texas or read about the University of Virginia, when you have people that have an agenda that they're trying to push, that's not the culture, and that's not the culture of the board, and it's also not a constructive approach when you have to work with 11 other colleagues to make decisions. So I guess in thinking about that that question, I would avoid candidates who have a very overt and strong agenda that they're trying to push.
Thank you. Lois?
Madam Chair, Executive Director Steeves, following up on that, not a challenging statement,
yeah.
but how to. Anybody who would come to the Regents, number one, cares passionately, as Regent Cohn has stated. Number two, they bring some form of expertise, and they bring a lens. Mm-hmm. And whenever anybody has a lens, they look through it. And so to that end, without stepping over the line into overtness, and from the collaborative and collegiality context, how does one say, here's a new path, I think we ought to look at this one. We haven't been doing this. Let's review this. How does one do that effectively within the Regents? That's based on that answer, we could work backwards to try to decipher in candidates what's overt and what isn't.
I go back to some of the themes that I talk about. You need people who are willing to listen to other perspectives and be open to other ideas. There's a difference between people that you encounter that have their perspectives and their lenses that they're looking through and are yet still open to a dialogue and a constructive path and willing to compromise and look at alternate options. And somebody who we've all encountered folks like this who has their point of view and believes that there's only one truth and it's the one that they hold. And I'm not saying, and I would echo too, I think that the process that we've had, as much as it's been criticized, I look at processes all around the country. I haven't found a single state that does it the way we do it, and yet I look at the others, and I wouldn't trade ours for any of the others either, because I think that the processes that other states use are worse. They're very overtly political.
Mm-hmm. I wasn't so much going to that. I was going to what guidance do you have about how, within the context of the board, new patterns of action are commenced and successfully moved forward, perchance.
I could just mention a specific example. I think that the board is pretty open to new ideas. Usually they're run through the leadership of the board, the chair and vice chair and the executive director and so on. But a case in point is the committee that Paul alluded to, which is Chair Beeson felt that the board needed to be more knowledgeable in the academic medicine field. And so a new committee, just a sort of a two-year committee was created, the Committee on Academic Medicine, so that at least half the board would be involved in really looking more closely at the health sciences. So there are ways for new things.
That's precisely the kind of thing that I was after. So then from that collegial group, collaborative group, new suggestions, et cetera, can come forward.
Absolutely.
I mean, I look at lots of things that I think have come from the board. As an example, some of the long-range financial planning that the university is doing now was driven by the board. Those are things that came out of board conversations. Some of the discussions around benchmarks and measures and those areas, those came out of board conversations. So there's a lot of things that really do come out of that process and those conversations, but you have to be willing to work with colleagues, work with the president, find ways to do it in a way that, so it may not be done exactly the way you wanted it done, but the fact that together you've come up with a pathway that works, I think, is the important thing.
Thank you much.
I think we have time for one or two more questions. Anyone have anything that you want to ask? Going once? Okay. Let's move on then. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
This was very informative. Thank you.
Thank you for all your hard work.
So next we have an update from our past chair, Pat Duncanson.
Thank you, Sally, for that title and in the agenda there. And actually, George had asked me before the meeting, before we got started, what became of some action items. And as we review the minutes from last time, there, as I looked at them, there were three motions that this board passed that affected some work that happened this summer. One of them was... stated it was Jim Erickson had moved that the executive committee explore with legislative leaders a modification of the proposed schedule. And Margaret Carlson made a motion and that prevailed that we talk about that directed us to make a formal recommendation about the number of legislators that are appointed to the RCAC. And then Lois Josephson, it says recommended, I think moved that, that we limit the recommend, our recommendation is that we limit the legislative positions on the RCAC to four legislators. The executive committee, kind of a blend of the old and new executive committee, so myself and Harriet and David Fisher and also Margaret Carlson, we did meet, had a very good session with Senator Bonhoff. We were invited into her home, and it was very informal discussion, and we addressed all of those issues and talked directly with her about it. She helped us carry that message to the House leadership as well. And we had a very good, frank conversation about pros and cons of our recommendation of limiting to no more than four legislators being on this committee. The other discussion revolving around scheduling and time, and we threw out and we tried to brainstorm some different ideas, and we really didn't come up with a very good way to modify our schedule from our current and past practice schedules. So it was a very productive time spent with Senator Bonhoff. Harriet, you were there. Anything about those particular points you'd like to add?
No. When we did introductions earlier, we actually did not talk about the outcome of that work that was being done. So I think this is as an appropriate time as any to bring this forward. Representative Pulaski has been named to the committee for a six-year term. No one else from the House has been named at this point in time. And Sonia Carnes and Shelley Buck have been reappointed. So we still don't have appointments on the Senate side.
Madam Chair, we still have a couple of openings from the House side as well. The House is not done with their appointments.
That is correct. We are still waiting to hear about appointments or reappointments on the health side.
Madam Chair, was the discussion then that there would be two from each branch or four from each branch, House and Senate?
Our recommendation was a total of four, two on each side. And at this point in time, the House has chosen to only appoint Representative Pulaski as the legislator.
Just following up on what Regent Cullen said, trying to depoliticize the appointment process, was there any discussion about who will make the appointments, or are we going to have four of one political party all the way and more than politicize this group?
Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
So in our discussions, George, we tried to emphasize the term balance that Regent Cullen mentioned. And we used that term, and in our discussions with the senator that day, she heard us very loud and clear, and agreed with many of our points, and yet all of our conversation that day was an informal, non-binding discussion. We delivered the message to make sure it got to the leadership, and Regent Cullen assured us that it would, and it did get through the leadership. I've since followed up with, in particular, Senator Bonhoff. I'm sorry if I misspoke and said something earlier. I in particular, in our meetings this summer with Senator Bonhoff. I'm sorry. But I've since followed up with her on a couple of occasions by email and by phone call, and tried to keep the process moving forward. And all I can say is that the end result is today we don't have full appointments, and so we're starting our process without a full slate of RCAC members. We went through the last process without being quite full, but we were nearly all of the appointments and all of our chairs were filled. This time we're starting out at a much lower number. So we have greater challenges, and it might reflect on the responsibilities that those of us that are appointed and are sitting here, we still have the same amount or more tasks and work to get done, and we are, you know, facing a pretty big challenge.
So the message that I would have to take back to both sides really is that in order for us to be the most effective that we can possibly be, we need a full slate of RCAC members. And that in order for us to be the most effective and without being partisan, we need that balance. We welcome the leaders of the committees and recognize that we serve at the pleasure of the legislature. But in order for us to do the best job that we can possibly do, we really need this resolved.
In addition to delivering the message to Senator Bonhoff about the three motions that were passed and the discussion that ensued from that, we also had a very productive day in from the executive committee meeting, and I'd just like to share a few of those points as well. And again, these were informal discussions that those of us that were there that day had, but. In sitting down with Senator Bonhoff, and in particular the atmosphere that when she invited us into her home, it was a very productive environment that we were able to do that, and I thank her very much for that. We talked a little bit about how do we improve the process of selecting regent candidates and recruiting them, and we have talked about trying to strengthen the committee's transparency and relationship with our legislative leaders. So we're recognizing that as the executive committee, it's probably in our roles to lead that and to make sure we maintain open dialogue with legislative leaders, whether it be House and Senate committee members or even leaders of the House and Senate. So that's one of the outcomes of that meeting. Another outcome is to more formally recognize a policy role that The executive committee will likely follow, so that as we finish our cycles, the executive committee will sit down in a little bit more formal than we've done in the past to try to examine how our committee functioned and how the process worked and what we can do to continually improve that. We've done some survey work. Harriet has been passing around a Survey Monkey tool or organizing it the last couple cycles, and we would like to expand on that and do a little bit better job of asking ourselves, okay, what did we do well? What did we not do well? How can we do the process in a more efficient and a better manner? That's one of the pieces. Another piece that probably directly affects us, and I think it will become an important piece of our recruitment tool this year, is that we would like for each of the sitting legislators, certainly in the districts that have an open seat, to get contacted by the RCAC in something more than what we've done in the past. And in the past, we sent a letter, I believe, to all legislators. So we're examining ways to have better contact, and in particular with the legislators that have a that are in the district that has an open seat. Trying to increase transparency and also increase participation and drum up some additional candidates and get more people thinking. So whether that means that we will be asked as RCAC members to contact legislators in some way, whether it's a visit or a phone call or something. Another piece of the and actually that was a June 18th meeting day. Another piece of that day was a discussion that David Fisher had with some leadership from the UMAA, the University Alumni Association. And in the past, the Alumni Association has been a very active partner with us in trying to recruit and at one point was involved with even helping with the introduction of our recommended candidates. We have not used that format in the past few years. I believe the university, through David Fisher's report, the Alumni Association is interested in becoming more involved with the introduction of candidates and maybe in coordinating with our group for an activity for introducing to the legislators the recommended candidates as we put them forward after our January interview process. In particular, we recognize the need to try to get as much help from the UMAA as we can and to try to have a liaison as such that the executive committee, I believe, would appoint to make sure that dialogue with the UMAA continues. There are probably other groups, and based on the size of the RCAC, I think we're all going to be tasked with reaching out to those groups as part of our recruitment process and being maybe an unofficial liaison to many different groups. So as we tap into some of David Fisher's comments, who was the recruitment chair from the last couple of cycles, and as we look at our other contact lists, I think it's going to be a responsibility for all of us to really step up to the plate. And as we begin working on recruitment, to strengthen our relationships with those different constituencies around the state to help spread the word.
Jim?
Harriet, I stay in touch with the regents and legislators, so I think I can add a bit to the stock of knowledge here. I think we can expect that the Senate will move shortly to name Senator Bonhoeff and Senator Miller to this committee. That would allow them, and by the way, the delegation's work with Senator Bonhoeff was effective in that you recall that Senator Bonhoeff and Chair Pawlowski indicated they'd like to see four legislators, four senators, and four representatives. And our position was two, and Senator Bonhoeff accepted that and has recommended it to her leadership. And her leadership, I think, will move forward on those two. The House has, as indicated, appointed Representative Pawlowski. I don't know whether it was they had less flexibility, and Representative Pawlowski would then take the seat, the reappointing seat of either Bert, excuse me, Bert Swanson or Jennifer Godinez. One of them, if Representative Pawlowski has been, he has been appointed. I don't know to which seat, but they were waiting which of those two, if they wish a reappointment, would fill in. The Senate still has the ability to reappoint Bert Swanson and Brad Slauson. It's my indication, I believe, they will appoint Margaret Carlson. So I think we're getting closer to a full House. And I never bet on things that you kind of think will happen in politics and legislature, but I think we can expect that. So kudos to the group for carrying our message about two. I think practically two, they didn't want to. They had a lot of people that would like to be reappointed, so four would have been a big bite
This
year. Whether they continue in the next cycle,
sure.
I want to add two more as an open question.
Sure.
And I think they view this as an experiment. I'm very much in favor of it. I think it will add to the credibility and our message going across the street with them participating.
Sure.
As we pointed out, it will be a daunting week to get those busy legislators to sit in this room for how many hours do we spend to do all the interviews. But to the extent they do, I think that would be helpful, and I think that's supportive. But I think that's the direction it's going. So we'll wait to hear from the House about perhaps another legislator, perhaps Representative Nornes.
Sure.
But that's an open seat. That they'll have to do that. Maybe Mr. Malander knows something about that. I don't know. But I think that they're moving to fill these, to give us a full complement in the near term.
Sure. Jerry?
Jim can enlighten me some. I'm still unclear as to whether the intention is for this to be a new type of position on council versus the legislators being from the legislative districts that are typically appointed to the seats.
Jerry, I'm not sure. You're talking about these appointments that we just talked about.
Yeah, or the future ones you're talking about, if they're altering it, because my understanding was there was going to have to be some change in the rules if these are based strictly on those people being on this council based on their position.
I don't know about that. I'm not familiar. I mean, there are openings. The legislature says there are openings, and they are the appointing authorities, and they've chosen to appoint those folks. I don't think there's any restrictions or prescriptions for that. Am I wrong? Sally?
Yeah, Jim, you're correct. They don't have to. The statute does not need to be changed. They can appoint whoever, legislator or not. And right now it doesn't say the chair, but they can certainly appoint the chair because they're free to appoint whomever.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, as I understand it, and Sally, please confirm, so as Representative Pawlowski is appointed, he is appointed to the RCAC for a six-year term as Gene Pawlowski, not as chair of the House Higher Ed Committee.
Correct. That's what the form looked like. I mean, because it's not per appointing authority. Sometimes if you're appointed, you're per the appointing authority, so you would go off after 2 years. But I think because of the statute, they are appointed as like a regular member to a six-year term. The letter I received said he was appointed until 2021, which seems crazy to see, 2021.
That he's on that long, but that we're that close to 2021.
Madam Chair, one other point I would like to make out and like to make is that one of the things, one of the brainstorming ideas that we came up with was trying to have a better relationship. And I'm very happy today to see the staff members from the House and Senate Committee. Thank you for being here. This is a great step. This helps with our dialogue and our transparencies.
Thank you. And I would also like to make the point that when I was talking about needing a full House, we have a lot of work that has to be done to recruit the strongest, best pool of candidates. And it is much easier to do with a 24-member body than it is with 12 or 14. So any last comments before we move on? Okay.
Madam Chair.
Lois?
I do have one question. Did I understand correctly that Bert Swanson and Jennifer Godin as were both originally House appointees and that they were both eligible for reappointment at this time?
Jennifer has chosen not to reapply.
And Bert's eligible.
Okay.
Next, let's move on to the selection committee report. And I would like to say that Kathy has done a phenomenal job of taking the selection criteria to the next level.
And George.
And George. Kathy as chair with George supporting her.
And if you look in your packet, you'll see a memo from Brian Steves dated August 15th. We had this in preparation for our meeting a couple weeks ago and really appreciate his efforts in giving us something to look at and what the Board of Regents is looking for in a replacement candidate. I'm not going to go over it. We've incorporated a lot of his thoughts into the document that's called Revised from the 115-13 Criteria Report, which is a blue line document. And we're going to look at both of those together right now. I'm just going to go through really quickly and talk about the changes that we've made and kind of our thoughts behind it, and then would like to enter into a discussion if people think that there should be revisions that are made, and then we can get our final list put together at the end of our discussion. So in the personal section, number two, going back to the issue of conflict of interest that was raised by both Regent Cohen and Brian Steves, we added the conflict of interest policy here and made reference to the Code of Ethics because we wanted it to be addressed right up front that people might have to deal with conflict of interest issues, and it was also a basis for us to talk about it during the interview process. And then in number five, we wanted to flesh out what the ability to think long-term meant and utilize some of the notes that Brian Steves had placed in his memo to us about both the short-term and long-term implications of decisions that are being made at the region level. George had an excellent point on 7 and 8, which used to be one item, and we broke them apart so that we could focus on both the role with the administration as well as the role with the president. We wanted to see them as two separate things and not have, as the sentence had read before, it looked like the role of evaluating the performance of the president was subordinate to the work with the administration. In number 11, and this is where I think we're going to need some discussion. We had, I was fortunate to have a few minutes to speak with President Kaler about what his needs were and what he thought about Regents coming onto the board. And there's two things that he mentioned. One was someone that had practical knowledge of how to run an organization and a complex organization like the university has. And then also he emphasized that there are certain skills that are rolling off the board right now, IT experience, healthcare. And we wanted to address that, but we didn't want to put in healthcare or IT because we wanted these to be generic and we didn't want to have people not apply that would be great candidates because they don't have that specific type of experience. So we've added operational needs from a functional perspective, not from a you must have operational management perspective. So we might need to tweak those words a bit. And then in number three, we, getting back to President Kaler's comment, we changed that to be both a governance and a strategic oversight role, getting at what he was hoping to have was people with practical experience, knowing how to work with a large organization. And we deleted the part about the national and global context because it just didn't fit with the sentence, and we felt that number 11 in the personal section dealt with the international awareness aspect, and we didn't feel that we needed to repeat it again. And then in number four, George did a wonderful job of kind of beefing up that most essential role of what a region does about, you know, understanding the role of the university and the trends that are going on and filled that part out. And so we've just kind of strengthened that, what we feel is, you know, a key role for the university. So I'll give you guys a few moments to digest and then would love to have any, you know, thoughts or changes or thumbs up that you have regarding these proposed changes.
And I would add that there is one additional sentence on the back side. Mm-hmm. Let's take a moment and read through this and then open it for discussion.
Madam Chair,
yes.
Just as a point of clarification, this list of criteria, help me remember, is this part of the application or is this just part of our website information to candidates?
Go ahead, Sally. It's statutorily required to be included with the application packet.
Okay.
So applicants must have this document.
Thank you. Madam Chair?
Yes.
I move we accept this these changes as presented.
Do we have a second?
Second.
All in favor, say aye.
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 Thank you, Kathy and George.
Without even any discussion.
I know.
Thank you.
And thanks, Brian, because Brian did a wonderful job writing the memo that really got us to a place to refine these. So we really appreciate their input. It was very helpful.
Thank you, Brian.
Jerry? Just a comment as I read through this, and then I believe they gave George the credit for putting that number four in there. I think that really hits the whole basis of what the region's job is about, understanding higher education and the role it has in the state of Minnesota. Yeah.
And as someone who chaired this selection committee criteria in the past, I appreciate what you've done to take it to the next level. So thank you very much. From there, what we'd like to do is to move into a discussion around the materials that we have. And Sally's actually going to talk about this before we talk about the recruitment effort. We're actually going to talk about the materials that are provided to candidates and review those.
So this is probably nothing new to most of you except Daryl and Bert. In your packet is just the general application packet. It's all online and in separate links, but this is what we provide to applicants. The first page is the letter from the chair, and that just lists the other items that are included. And everything has just really been updated to reflect this cycle. Last year, we really updated the application, you may recall, because to align with the Data Practices Act. So we put a lot of work into that last time. So it's just really updated to reflect the districts up for this year and then the dates for the meeting. There's no, or the dates for the interviews and meetings. So there's really no major changes. And then the others, documents are things we provide that are just the University of Minnesota Board of Regents policy and their code of ethics and the selection criteria and our schedule once it's approved. So I don't know if anyone has any updates or changes they'd like to suggest, but that's pretty much the application materials.
Madam Chair, Sally, I noticed that you did a good job and have updated our website with the membership and the chair and the like, but the section for application material still refers to the 13 cycle.
Right. So I was waiting for today.
Okay.
Then I'll change it this afternoon.
Thank you.
Kathy? I know we had talked about this offline, but did we finalize what we were going to do about background checks? Is that going to be part of this application process, or?
I'm trying to remember last time what we did. Let me check with counsel after this to see what's appropriate and what we can do.
Okay.
Thank you for bringing that up, Kathy. That was an open question on our list as well. So we will let you know as soon as we have resolution on that. At issue was whether or not we could include a clause of which applicants signed, giving us permission to do background checks beyond references. So basically, criminal background checks were what we were most concerned about.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
As I'm looking through this application, help me remember, and this was probably work we did last time, how much of this application is public information and how much of it remains less than public?
So actually in the first clause of the application, it outlines what is public and what is not, so people know up front what of their information. And it highlights throughout, but it's like name, city, residence, education and training, employment history, volunteer work, award honors, prior government service, and veteran status. So the references, contact information, the telephone number, email information of the candidate, and the answers to the essay questions aren't public unless they check that they're willing to make that information public. Not the references, though. Those are always private.
Thank you. And I asked that question just to make sure we all understood what parts are and aren't public.
So what I'd like to do now is we're going to talk about our committees, but because we are in the section around recruitment, what I'd like to do is share with you that Paul Taylor has generously agreed to serve as the chair of the recruitment committee, a very, very important role. And I'm going to turn it over to him and let Paul share with you his thoughts on how we might approach recruitment this time. The one caveat that I have is that while we might not all sign up to be on the recruitment committee, we all have a role to play. And particularly while we are a smaller committee, we will all really have to put forth significant effort in recruiting candidates this time. So with that, I'll turn it over to Paul.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Pat Duncanson, for making specific reference of a partnership with UMAA. A woman, no, it's okay, Lois. A woman came to the meeting a little late. She was sitting towards the back on that far side. She's Lisa Lewis. She is the CEO of the Alumni Association and has been in that position for about 15 months. I've had the privilege of working with her as an Alumni Association volunteer and will certainly be following up with her and her staff soon to strengthen that partnership. A thought in mind, knowing that we have four openings from four separate congressional districts in this current cycle, that we try to find what I'm referring to at the moment as a team captain or co-captains for each of those four geographic locations. Lois Josephson, a resident of Fergus Falls, has agreed to help in the 7th Congressional District. I've had an informal conversation with Jerry Rogers about a similar role. Pat Duncanson in the 1st Congressional District, even though Daryl Thompson's official residence is now in the 3rd Congressional District, people in Rochester still know who he is, and he gets there on a regular basis. So that's just a sense of how we want to get organized going forward. Make the best possible use of the Alumni Association. They have probably a half a dozen local chapters in the combination of these four congressional districts. I know the woman who's the regional director, and we'll follow up with her as well to get introductions. The possibility of them having events in Wilmer or Alexandria or whatever, so that we're really getting our face out to our community to help with the recruitment. We've got a lot of work to do in a relatively short period of time. You can see in our materials, we want those applications by the 1st of December. And if my calendar is correct, that's a little less than 90 days from today. So to Harriet's point that we've all got to be involved in the recruitment effort. So that's a very, you know, high-level overview of the plan. But I think that if we all get involved and really think about our responsibilities, that we'll be successful.
Thank you, Paul. And we'll have an additional time to talk with Paul about this as we move forward. What I'd like to do now is let's move on to a quick review of the Data Practices Act and Open Meeting Law before we talk about committees. So I'm going to ask Sally to speak about this.
So I'm not going to get too into depth, but in your packet there's a memo that House Research put together for us last year, just going over the Open Meeting Law and the Data Practices Act. I just want to make sure as we start working on these subcommittees, everybody keep in mind to, you know, we are subject to the Open Meeting Law. Try not to do things over email, or don't do things over email like replying all and having discussions and meetings. We really want to make sure everything is open and to the public. And then as applications come in, and I will send this out when I send the link to the applications, just really keep in mind the Data Practices Act and how those applicants are protected from specific information getting out. So that's just it, just stuff to keep in mind as we move forward.
And if you do have questions about the Data Practices Act and whether something you are planning to do or would like to do needs clarification, please reach out to Sally. She is well-versed in this and can tell us what we can and can't do.
Can I just, Jerry? Question. You mentioned the email issue. Does that extend to all the other social media kind of connections?
I mean, it probably doesn't. I would advise against it. Like if you're Facebooking something about an event and it's more of a quorum of you, then no. Really, it's just a matter of just don't be conducting the committee's business. Yeah, you know, on, I guess, social media, I guess, could be public, but just really try and not do reply alls and talk about business and recruiting. I think we'll probably be fine.
Madam Chair, maybe I didn't hear this completely, but if there is a subcommittee that doesn't comprise a majority of this entire group, is it still violation of open meeting law to discuss by email between that subcommittee?
If it's an established committee, that's correct. So it would be a quorum of the subcommittee. So if there's four of you, then three is a quorum.
Thank you. Thank you.
Anything else? Okay. You have a sheet in your folder that currently has committees listed. If you could pull that out. It has 2014, 2015 at the top. Jim, I have you listed as candidate orientation. Is that still agreeable to you?
I'd be honored to serve as that, yes, and with the help of Lois and Bert and Bill, if he's reappointed.
Okay. For recruitment, we have Paul, so we're good there. Kathy had selection criteria report, so we're still looking for a chair for the interview process and questions and the reference committee. And right now, Kathy is serving also on the document review committee, and I will serve with Kathy on that committee.
Yeah.
If you go to the back side of the page, there is a description of each one of the committees. So do we have any volunteers for the open chair roles?
Madam Chair, on the reference committee, I'm not I'm not averse to being chair of the committee, but I'm wondering how much work will be done here in the metro area on that, where I'm not really in the metro area.
Yeah, I don't think where you're located plays a significant role, George. It really is coordination of the reference checking process and committee and at those activities. And most of the reference checking, quite frankly, has been by phone. And it doesn't mean that you need to do all of the reference checking. It just means that you need to provide leadership to the committee around this. And Paul is still listed on this committee. And I don't want to speak for Paul, but I would imagine that Paul would be willing to do some knowledge transfer to you about what he's done in the past. Is that fair, Paul?
Only with this one qualification. I have no idea how much there is. But more important than that, where it's located. So no one should have great expectations that I'll press send this afternoon and suddenly some wonderful knowledge transfer will have occurred.
Fair enough, Paul. Thank you. So, George, is that a volunteer?
Yeah.
Thank you very, very much.
Madam Chair, point of clarification, as we go through this process, and the definition of the open meeting law and how that applies, if there's two or three people on a committee, can two people have a conversation?
We'd probably still do it open. I mean, we would hold the meeting here, and as long as one person is physically here, it's fine, and the other person could call in.
But so would it help with the compliance of open meeting if there were, for instance, as an example, four people, so that two people could have a conversation outside of the open meeting and not be in violation? Just to facilitate the work of committees.
Yes, that would help. I mean, we can send meeting notices, and I can send that kind of stuff via email and check people's availability. That's all fine. It's just...
But sometimes complying with that open meeting qualification, not that we're doing anything behind, you know, the Emerald Curtain at Oz here.
Right. And most of these committees have one brief meeting.
But it would... But it might be really difficult to get work done. Yeah. Okay. So at that suggestion, Madam Chair, I think we need to move towards having probably four people on committees.
Yes. Which is where I was going next.
I'm sorry.
Thank you. That's absolutely fine, Pat. We definitely want to make sure that we have full committees that are capable of and have the capacity of doing the work. We don't want any one person. I see Paul's name on multiple committees here, and there's only one Paul, and Paul is taking on a very large role with the recruitment chair role. So I want to make sure that all of the responsibility is not falling on the shoulders of a few. So what I would ask is, before you leave today, make sure that you have signed up for a couple of committees, and that if you have questions about any of the committees, ask those questions and we'll make sure that you get answers. There are some names missing on here where we have RCAC members that have not joined a committee yet. I can promise you that we'll try to streamline things and make it as easy as possible to serve in this capacity, but we do need everybody's participation. Jerry?
A question. For example, the recruitment and reference committees, essentially everybody participates.
That is true.
And that's kind of fine line whether they're part of the committee or not. You know, the committee kind of plans and methods, but really the functions are done by everybody on the RCAC.
That is correct.
So I guess my maybe I was getting at is I noted this morning I wasn't on any of them. I assumed I stayed on ones until I left them, but I guess we have to sign up each time. That was not acknowledged by me, but that's what I'm saying. So some of these, essentially, everybody here is already on them automatically.
The recruitment and reference checking are the two where we are all involved, so absolutely. So which six committees would you like to serve on, Jerry?
How many are there?
Madam Chair?
Six, I guess.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Lois.
Okay. to that conversation, I think there's a difference between all involved and on the committee. So, yes, we're all involved in doing references, but if there's going to be a procedural discussion about how those references should be done in a small group as versus this total group, that would be the names that would show up here. And that procedural discussion set of names here is what would be governed by the open meeting law. Not the fact that we all do end up doing references. That doesn't pull us all into that, if that's helpful.
Sure. Okay. What I'd like to do is give you a little bit of time for the remainder of the meeting after we finish to think about where you want to serve and then to sign up before you leave today. So we're going to move on.
Madam Chair, may I also recommend maybe that the Executive Committee also will review the committee sign-up and might make special requests for appointments.
If we don't have enough volunteer participation, we will reach out and try to fill these roles with candidates that we believe would do the best job.
Madam Chair, quick question on reference checks. How many candidates in a given year do we expect? What's the history been?
Sal, can you talk to that?
Whose references have to be checked?
References aren't checked until after a candidate is selected to be interviewed. So there's generally 14 to 16 candidates, and each member of the council takes one or two people and calls their references.
And beyond, just from a practical standpoint, not only are they calling the references, but they're typically expanding that reference check and gathering as much information as possible. Yes?
Madam Chair, should you be looking for a chair still for interview process and questions? I'm happy to volunteer for that.
Thank you very much. That fills that one.
I'm willing to be on that interview.
Okay. Wonderful. Thank you.
Madam Chair,
yes.
Before we leave this area, when Mr. McKaysey asked how many applicants we normally have, we've had a lot of applications that we never interviewed. I don't recall doing background checks on people that we did not interview. So
we do not.
Thank you. That's all I needed to know.
We do not. Thank you. Okay. Any further discussion on the committees before we move on? Okay. Let's move on to the 2014-2015 schedule, which is in blue. And I'm actually going to ask Sally to cover this because I think I'm losing my voice here.
So there's really this is pretty much what you saw at the last meeting in August. Obviously, we changed the meeting today the last meeting in June. We changed the August meeting to today, September 4th. The other change is the distribution of the press release announcing the candidate search. That just got pushed back to give Paul in the recruitment some time to look that over and Ardell, the chair, to look it over as well. But otherwise, everything is pretty much as presented. The same application deadline, the same Friday, December 12th day to meet to review the applications and select candidates to interview, and then reserving that same week, which is the first full week of January after the holidays, to conduct the interviews. And the interviews generally take about 3 days, depending on the number of candidates.
And Sally, should we be planning on the whole day on December 12th?
If I said no, then you would need to be here the whole day. I'm never lucky on that. I would say a few hours. We may even want to consider lunch.
Yeah,
but
I would plan for the whole day. We don't know how many applications we'll be going through, and so better safe than sorry, and we will plan to do lunch.
Madam Chair?
Yes?
On the schedule, this pertains to something that was discussed before, how to make the process a little bit more elegant and perhaps less political. In talking to, and I've been active in recruiting some folks that, in fact, were around last time, you know, 6 years ago.
Sure.
And to a person, they all say, why would we want to do that again? That's something we have to pay some attention to. So I'll give notice that on when we meet on January 9th and have our recommendations, I'm going to suggest that we actually take a formal vote and tell our legislative colleagues who sit at the committee with us that we would strongly encourage them to not wait the full 7 weeks to have the joint committee. And because the statutory deadline, which isn't listed on here, is the joint committee must meet by February 28th. And we would do a great favor to our nominees to not have that be a seven-week process. So, you know, that's something they'll take under consideration. And I hope that the chairs, Pawlowski and Bonhoff, would be sensitive to that. But I think if we can tell folks with some assurance, well, we can't tell them with assurance that it might not be a seven-week hell week, because that's what goes on. They just take a lot of time. And that's, a significant deterrent to some candidates. So I hope when we talk to legislators and we take a position then that we'll have a very good slate of candidates, but we encourage the legislature to act quickly. That would be, I think, helpful to everyone.
Madam Chair.
Point noted. Yes.
That was one of the discussion points that we had with Senator Bonhoff, and she was very receptive to the ideas. I think it's probably something that as we have conversations with legislators throughout this process that we keep reaffirming that viewpoint, that it's obviously beyond our control. But it would be, if we can encourage them to make that process for the recommended candidates as short and concise as possible in respect for the applicants.
I think you're spot on in terms of that direction, Jim. And I think to your point also, candidates don't apply because of what they hear about the process. And so anything that we can do to improve that is very important. And I would also encourage us as we look at this in hindsight after we go through this process this time to pay careful attention to how it works this time and what we might change going forward around this piece as well.
On that point, Madam Chair, one more thing. The 6th District was what I was referring to because 6 years ago in the 6th District, there were two people recommended by this committee, Catherine Roberts and Shell Berg. And I went to both of them and said, would you be interested in applying mm-hmm. again? And that was their response. Why would we do that again? Catherine Roberts has unfortunately moved from the 6th District to the 4th District, so she is not eligible for that spot. I don't know about Shell Berg. Sure. I suppose that must be true of the 1st and 7th and the 4th. Okay, so I presume perhaps some of those people that were recommended or applied then might be interested again.
Sure. Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Pat.
A couple of points. One specific about the agenda, in that there was discussion with the executive board about, within the executive board about the December 1st deadline and how much time we logistically need as and particularly Sally as far as being able to get the applications that come in. And so I've been around in this process pre-electronic technology days where we used to get the applications in. Sally would have to physically copy them. Oh, okay. That was even before your time.
Well, for a couple people, maybe I had to copy
them. Okay. And then put them in a thing called mail, and then they would get delivered to my rural Mapleton, Minnesota mailbox. That process took several days. We're lucky now, and that electronics makes that much easier. But we're still at a point. We used to extend the deadline as we got to a certain point, and we'd recognize that the talent pool wasn't deep enough, and so we would make a public announcement and extend the deadline for applications. We've already built that into the process in that we probably can't extend the deadline past December 1st. So I think last cycle we had a deadline that was the deadline and there wasn't room to expand it, and I think we've got that built in this schedule as well. So I just wanted to make that point.
Sure. Okay, so any further discussion on the schedule and timeline? Thank you. Other business. Does anyone have any other? Can we have someone move to approve the schedule and timeline? I apologize.
I'll second.
All in favor, say aye.
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 Okay. So moved. Any other business that we want to cover today?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I think as long as Mr. Duncanson is no longer the chairman, I think we owe him a bit of gratitude for the job that he did for the last 2 years as chairperson. I think it was very difficult, and I think he did a very yeoman's job doing what he did there.
I would agree with that, Pat. Absolutely. And Pat continues to serve as an advisor to the Executive Council, or the Executive Committee, and continues to be involved, as a leader on the committee. So we appreciate that very, very much.
Thank you. There were a lot of great examples that I could follow, and a lot of great help to make it all happen this past year, too.
So if there is no other...
Just a question I should bring up here. The one thing I just thought about, Pat referred to being an advisor to the Executive Committee, and I think some of us have talked about, should the past chair be a member of that committee?
Yeah, it's not a formal committee. So
it's listed on some more version.
Right. If we were a formal committee, we would be held to different standards. And so it works best if we remain informal, so that we can have meetings, et cetera. And we can certainly talk more about that offline as well. Okay, if there is no other business, I will ask for a motion to adjourn and give you back 19 minutes, which we will probably tack on to one of our later meetings when we need it most.
So move.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Adjourned.